The first method consists in placing the body in a specific unusual posture and keeping it fixed and unmoving therein for some time. The second method involves various peculiar exercises in rhythmically disciplining for set periods of time the inhalation, retention and expulsion of the breath. The third method is the practice of looking with unwinking eyes at some particular point for the same period of time every day. The fourth method is to mutter 1001 times daily a scriptural name of God. The fifth method is to chant specified sacred syllables in rhythmic conjunction with the ingoing and outgoing breaths. The second or intermediate group of yoga practices rises beyond the gross body to the higher level of educating the feelings in devotion and training the thoughts in concentration. It includes various mystical exercises in meditation whose ultimate aim is the attainment of emotional and mental peace. It may also embrace the inculcation of constant yearning for the presence of God. The generic character of this group will be outlined in the next chapter. His meditative reveries and ecstatic trances give the aspirant glimpses of the world's basis non-materiality and of its underlying harmonious unity, but these glimpses are nothing more in the end than transient if exalted feelings. He has next to learn how to convert them into permanent understanding, which can be done only by interpreting them in the higher light of reason, an activity which belongs to another stage. Successful attainment in this second degree is marked by the power to attain and remain in prolonged reverie with perfect concentration, and with attention withdrawn from outward surroundings. With the profits in self-preparation gained from the business of these earlier methods, he climbs to the third step, the yoga of philosophical discernment. This is the highest group of the yoga family. It is finally super-mystical but initially purely intellectual and rational. It is the hidden doctrine. Part of it is outlined in this book, but before the threshold of the advanced portion with its final astonishing revelation, the yoga of the uncontradictable, these pages must perforce stop for the present. In this third stage the student strives, along with concentrated and disciplined feeling and thought, to sharpen his reason and to apply that sharpened intelligence to a guided philosophical consideration of the meaning and nature of the whole world and of all life. Hitherto he has been preoccupied entirely with himself, with his own little ego. Now he expands the entire horizon of his outlook and makes the world problem his own problem. He must train himself thoroughly to impress these new ideas upon every atom of his being. He must think deeply and think hard about these subtle truths he learns until thought becomes established as insight. When these efforts finally and successfully mature, he reaches the very summit of the yoga of knowledge and seeks by the sheer power of his now illumined intelligence to fathom the final mystery of all, the relation between the grand ultimate reality of the world and himself. He has reached the climax of an adventure where his whole mind and body must now travel and strive and toil in unison. This peak path is the yoga of the uncontradictable. It first proves its own ultimate tenet of the secret identity of man with the universal reality, and then shows him how to realize this amid practical life. Higher than this his mind cannot go, and his remaining years will be engaged in unremittingly establishing the truth in his own consciousness, in living with it every moment and every day, in expressing it practically with sustained and uncompromising thoroughness, in repeatedly dwelling in its spirit and atmosphere until it loses every vestige of unfamiliarity and becomes first-hand, ascertained and verified knowledge. Knowledge must become dynamic by getting itself practiced until the practice itself is lost in its complete fulfillment. He has then finished with the formalities of religion, with the visions of meditation, with the reasonings of philosophy. Just as a scaffolding is carefully erected and remains throughout the building of a house, only to be ruthlessly torn down at the end, so first religion, then yoga, and finally philosophy, are now seen to be but scaffoldings which enabled him to build up the structure of truth. In the end and when climbed they too are all rejected. But this rejection applies only to their claims to give realization of the truth through their individual channel alone, and not to their lesser uses. Once permanently established, the master may dwell in all these different worlds, if he wishes, and be equally at home in each. He may still study philosophy for the sake of guiding the mental currents of his time. He may conform to the rites and requirements of orthodox religion for the sake of encouraging others who cannot rise beyond it. He may even enter into meditative trances for the sake of personal relaxation, but he will never again be deluded into regarding any of them as sole and final avenues to truth. At best they may yield its reflection in thought. He himself must become conscious of its substance, and no wizardry will do this. The reader will misunderstand these explanations if he does not grasp the important point that those who have not mastered the yoga of the second degree will therefore not be able to master the yoga of the highest degree. For the practice of reverie is needed to render successful the pursuit of philosophy. Inquiry into truth is the content which should fill the meditative trance. Ascetic discipline of the will, the body and the ego must run side by side with their study, and implement in action the theoretical findings of philosophy. Yoga as it is ordinarily understood is therefore not to be given up, albeit it no longer becomes an end in itself but only a means to the end. The capacity to practice yoga is not only essential at the very beginning of but also at its terminus. It is the perfect combination of keen rational inquiry merged into profound meditative reverie and revealing its logical consequences in practical daily living that yields the fruit of ultimate realization in the end. The mere intellectual grasp of the hidden teaching without the parallel yogic capacity to sustain that grasp unbrokenly is as partial, as incomplete and as unsatisfactory as the mere yogic power to withdraw attention from externals and hold it in abstracted moods unfilled by philosophic effort. Neither a dry academic intellectualism nor an unenlightened yoga practice can lead to truth, nor both if unvivified by action. Thus the novice graduates from one degree to another, from the bodily discipline to emotional discipline and thence to the intellectual. The three groups combine to constitute a progressive unfoldment of his capacities and understanding. It is important to note that they are steps, not stops. The truth that he learns is always proportionately relative to his level of understanding. The confusion between the second and third yogas is somewhat general throughout the religious and learned world of India today. Patanjali is often quoted, but he speaks only of the goal of controlling the mind and the senses, not of union of the soul with the ultimate. It is true that he makes a reference to Ishvara, God, but this is done only to indicate a method of practice. Those who would make the yoga of mental concentration a final path are utterly mistaken. The Bhagavad Gita plainly declares in the 15th chapter that there is nothing equal to the yoga of knowledge, and in the 13th chapter that it is the highest means of realization. Therefore we must not confuse matters. We must keep religion clear from mysticism in our minds, and mysticism clear from philosophy. If through sentiment, habit or error we mistake one for the other, we shall lose our path and end in bewilderment. It will be seen that the various yoga methods successively lead from one to another and are emphatically not paths leading to a common central goal, as is popularly but erroneously taught nowadays in India. Did not Amarama Swami himself, the author of the standard classic manual on the yoga of body control entitled Hatha Yoga Pradipika, confess that he had composed it to help those people who found it impossible to practice the yoga of mental concentration? It is only for the attainment of concentration yoga that body control yoga has been prescribed, he wrote. The popular yogas are quite inadequate to the high purpose of supreme realization. At best they yield mediate or indirect knowledge of truth, but never truth itself. They are but units in a progressive series, preliminary rungs in a ladder, and we must step from one to the other in order to rise higher. No single round will bring us to the top except the culminating one. Similarly, no single yoga is self-sufficient and none will bring final realization except the culminating yoga of the uncontradictable. The term yoga is a wide umbrella which shelters many diverse ideas and practices. It covers the ascetic squatting in self-torture on a bed of spikes as well as the thoughtful philosopher who applies his wisdom to practical life. That is why those who would limit yoga to meditation practice whilst excluding philosophical inquiry adopt an unwarranted attitude. The practical value of each step nevertheless remains in its own place as much as ever. but to the few who originally take up yoga in the hope that it will lead them to truth above all else, who practice the elementary and intermediate methods with some degree of satisfying result, there is always the unspoken invitation to explore the higher method. If they entertain this invitation to supplement the yoga of experience with the yoga of knowledge, they will not be deserting the yoga scheme but will rather be fulfilling it. For the work of complete yoga does not end with meditation, nor does devotion exhaust its possibilities. The change can be made by the wise without any damage to their intellectual integrity, whereas the foolish will see only danger and disruption in the higher method. The danger is illusory and consists only in giving second place to the blissful experience of meditation which old habit has made them regard as primary, whilst the disruption they fear is only the yielding of intuitive feeling to the higher check of rational insight. They may keep their meditations and intuitions, nothing need be lost or given up, but the excessive claims of meditation and the stubborn extravagances of intuition to soul supremacy must be given up whenever they collide with philosophically trained reason. Indeed, the inability to practice meditation successfully, and incapacity to enter at will into sustained reverie, would render quite impossible the grand ultimate realization. They are asked to choose, therefore, between the winning of momentary peace and the winning of durable peace. The work of yoga does not end with meditation, does not end with devotion, does not end with postures or breathings, it ends only with established realization which alone yields a peace that is ever present whether the man practices his meditation or not. Thus reality may be conceived from four different standpoints, which are set along a path to be traveled by progressive stages. It may be first worshipped religiously as apart and separate from oneself. It may next be meditated on mystically as being within oneself. It may thirdly be studied philosophically by dropping all false conceptions of it. It may finally be realized consciously as what it is in itself and by ultra-mystical processes. Where I now stand, without the power to enter the mystical trance and without the emotional reorientation it brings about, philosophy can only end in sterile disappointing intellectualism. Life is a product of the whole man, and when philosophical thought has run its full course and yielded the truth which comes from making thought go as far as it can reach, yoga must again step in to implement the philosophical conclusions by its own unique power to absorb the world idea into the self. It is not through any arrogant estimation of my own insight that this book is offered to others, but rather through a desire to pass on to them an attitude of mind which has been of immense help in answering claim and questions. This is the best service I can render them. Let there be no misunderstanding about my present position in relation to these matters. I now follow a lone path. It is quite true to say that I have ceased to search for yogis and teachers in the conventional sense, and do not identify myself with their ashrams any longer. This is partly because I have personally exhausted the serviceableness of such a search, and partly because a long experience of certain ashrams and ascetics has fatally disenchanted me. Formerly I confused yogis and others with sages, as most of us do, but I know better now. I still regard my past mystic experiences as having been quite indispensable in their own place, and similar experiences will always be so to others. The change which has come over me lies in the direction not of denial but of interpretation of those experiences. Profounder research and better guidance have helped me to estimate their precise value and put them in their proper place. Nevertheless, they are essential phases of mystic experience which must be passed through by all seekers. Moreover, I would not dream of passing a single day without some interlude, however brief, of mental withdrawal from personal affairs and worldly activity into that serene beatific tranquility of profound meditation which long habit and constant practice have enabled me to attain at will at any moment and in any place. I have not given up meditation, but still keep it as a brief, attractive and essential part of the daily program. However, I refuse to confuse the issues any longer. Visions, ecstasies and intuitions are now the mere accidents of meditation and constitute its non-essential byproduct. There is no universal standard by which their validity may be gauged. Consequently, I know that it is better to keep the essential purpose of meditation solely in view. In two earlier books I promised to give eventually the complete intellectual statement of those ultimate truths which both fulfill and lie beyond yoga as it is ordinarily known. The work of formulating it in the present volume, which has long been awaited by an international audience, is not complete even now, and does not exhaust the full stock of what has yet to be given to the world. That task demands a second volume. What is here presented constitutes part but not all of the yoga of philosophical discernment alone. The remainder, together with the crowning keystone of the arch of truth which I am endeavoring to construct, has perforce been left untouched. If these pages kindle enough interest, then both the missing doctrines and the yoga of the contradictible, which is the last stone, will be built in and the task completed. The undertaking of the final volume will be extremely difficult and its separation from the present one is essential. For the latter not only acts as a bridge thrown across the chasm between my earlier work in mysticism and this newer work in pure philosophy, but it also reorientates the reader's mind and should effectually prepare him for the highly advanced study with which his rational quest may come to a close. Common language is defectively constructed as a medium for conveying abstract concepts. Hence the need usually felt for inventing a special philosophical terminology. I have tried, however, to remember for whom I am writing, and it is certainly not for cloistered pedants or academic metaphysics, but for men in the street who yet take some thought for the meaning of life, and hence have reluctantly refused to make use of this remote and unfamiliar terminology except where it is necessarily unavoidable or easily understandable. So far as could be, my researches into these complex abstractions have been brought down into the realm of non-technical language comprehensible to ordinarily intelligent people, without sacrificing their accuracy or depth. The brain-racking truths they contain were once confined to the closed circle of an intellectual elite, yet, although I have not written for morons, they have here been put into words so plain as to be understandable by most who can understand the words of a good class newspaper. Nevertheless, those who have never practiced meditation or concentration nor pursued philosophy may find no taste for such thoughts, while those who walk the narrow path of rigid religious orthodoxy will be scared by them. And every reader will find that although these pages are open and accessible to anyone who cares to pick them up, the penetration to their true meaning is closed to all who are unwilling to make a little mental effort. He would therefore do well to read but little at a time and then pause to reflect over the philosophical fruit he has thus plucked. It might be as well to anticipate in print some criticisms which I have already heard in private and even read in an Indian newspaper of the lowest class, which acts as the mouthpiece of certain pitiful creatures who have taken up the vain labors of personal enmity. These criticisms will certainly be more widely crystallized with the appearance of the present book. First, the charge of serious inconsistency will be laid against me. It will be said that I have iconoclastically shattered previous definitions and doctrines, changed an established viewpoint, altered earlier estimates of men and experience, and thus proved unstable in character and unreliable in judgment. Personal friends will doubtless be highly amused at the injustice of the last 10 words, whilst the general charge betrays a definite misunderstanding of my present outlook. I have not recanted old views but simply enlarged them. Anyway, the integrity of my purpose compels me to confess frankly that consistency is not my hobgoblin. I have concerned myself with it only so far as keeping up the quest of truth was concerned. If the results of that quest alter and differ as I advance, then let them. I shall not flinch from acknowledging the fact. The honesty of my past purpose gives me present courage to do so. For a writer who has established his fame on the basis of his researches into an advocacy of yoga, the open confession of its limitations is no easy matter. It should be obvious that only the weightiest reasons and the lengthiest experience led me to this responsible step. I am constantly engaged in learning and verifying new facts and in maturing my judgment. When this happens, it is inevitable that a man may have to modify his earlier conclusions and the earlier interpretations of his experiences, unless he is nothing more than a blind believer in what others tell him or a blind acceptor of whatever happens to him. This quest is like climbing an unfamiliar mountain, A journey which entails successive changes of landscape. You see what appears to be the summit high above. After much arduous effort and many arduous years, you reach the top of the ridge. Alas! At the fateful moment of success, you discover that the real summit lies still higher, and that you will have to struggle upward again for more arduous years before it greets your gaze. Mystical visions, yogic experiences, religious beliefs and scientific theories are ridges which you pass on the way up its steep sides and mistake time and again for the final peak. You get different and hitherto unsuspected views of the truth as the old landmarks disappear behind and you succeed in struggling higher. The ultimate exists, let us not doubt that. But if historic records read aright, it can be found only by those who have the courage to be inconsistent. Even the Buddha, when he glimpsed a loftier path, did not hesitate to reject elementary forms of yoga which he had practiced for 6 years. The second charge which has issued from ignorant lips is that I am a renegade. This is absurd nonsense, because I have never espoused any other cause than that of truth, to which I am still wedded. If uninquiring superficial minds have hitherto regarded me, as I am well aware they have, as a convert to Hinduism, or as a propagandist for some particular Indian ashram, that is their vain self-created presumption and was never my personal attitude. But if, however, a sincere passage from a lower to a higher point of view makes me a renegade, then I gladly plead guilty. The third charge, that I have disavowed yoga, is equally nonsensical. I have not lapsed from my own formulary. I do not oppose but continue to esteem it highly in its own place, as before, but I refuse any longer to concentrate my whole gaze upon it, rather do I try to appreciate, criticize and understand it more fairly against the larger background of ultimate truth. Moreover, I no longer accept every grossly exaggerated claim on behalf of the inferior yoga paths which uncritical irresponsible yogis care to make, and I now regard these paths as directing us eventually to a region beyond themselves. I do not disown yoga, but develop it. As a partner of philosophy, yoga will admittedly yield truth. Standing alone, it can only yield peace. The other charges, instigated by interested parties, are too petty and too ridiculous with which to spoil good paper, and shall receive the silent contempt of a clear conscience. Every truth seeker, every man who has dared to think honestly and to accept the results of his thought, whether they be as bitter as wormwood or as sweet as honey, has been a wanderer. His views have never been cast in iron finality. He knows that wisdom is the last residue left over from life's agitating process of distillation, and not the first. The quest on which he is engaged is a dynamic and not a static one. He cannot lower himself into an intellectual grave and put up the tombstone of a stubborn viewpoint to tell of his death. Therefore, I want as readers only those who are ready to go into the forbidding wilderness with me. The effort to discover truth is a grand adventure, an age-long move forward into increasing experience of the unknown and not a petty stay-at-home rut. The pioneer must labor and suffer to learn as a new truth that which his successors will enjoy as an old one. Consistency is to be worn like a welcome new suit of clothes when it helps the pursuit of truth, but it is to be discarded like a shriveled old one when it hinders it. Most questions are expansive, they have more sides than one. If the sails of a man's ship have veered in the past to this side and now veer to another, well, so much the better for a truer view. Time has certainly made me a little wiser in these matters, a little more critical of myself and my experiences, as well as of the renowned ashrams and bell-ordered mystics personally known to me. I have dug more deeply into their foundations to get clearer understanding of them. In this effort I have drawn on the findings of the most competent modern Western and ancient Indian psychologists. It would have been more flattering to my vanity to have followed a long company of fellow mystics, whether of dim antiquity or bright modernity, whether of the young West or the old East, in unquestioning acceptance of these extraordinary visions and ineffable experiences which I had previously viewed in the rosiest light, and let the matter rest there. But fate was kinder, and by hurting my self-esteem led me into a higher atmosphere of truth. Both delightful successes and dreadful disappointments were minor teachers which prepared the way. Most invaluable was philosophy's favor in showing me how to evaluate mystic visions by the light of that supreme truth which few care to seek because it crushes egoistic desire and shames every personal motive. Those, therefore, who will view this book as a symbol of the defect of inconsistency will view it wrongly. I have no need to apologize weakly before the bar of reason. Some of the new teachings here presented are not altogether inconsistent with my earlier statements. They were already known to me as long ago as the time of writing The Quest of the Over-Self, where it was plainly stated as follows in the first chapter that the last word was still unwritten: every writer or teacher must perforce take up a different position according to the grade of development of the mind with which he is dealing. The purpose of these pages should not be misconstrued. They are designed to show a yoga path suited to Western people. They show how to achieve certain satisfactions, but they do not attempt at this stage to solve the mystery of the universe. When peace of mind and concentration of thought have been gained, then only will one be fit and ready to embark on the quest of ultimate truth. We are still in the process of unveiling a subtle and startling wisdom which not one person in a million has yet grasped. And in the same chapter it was stated that in the Maharishi I had found the highest embodiment of Indian mysticism. The last word was deliberately used, though with all fitting respect. I had begun to perceive that truth lay as far beyond mysticism as the latter lay beyond religion. In the succeeding book I boldly and frequently admitted that mysticism was not enough and that there was an ultimate path beyond it. But only with the present work has the time arrived for a clear explication of the reasons for my change from a fragmentary to a fuller view. Every book that I have gathered out of the fluid gloom of ink represents, therefore, a milestone which has been passed, an oasis where I camped for a while on my journey through the desert of this world in search of a valid explanation of life and reality. I may never live to write a last philosophical will and testament or a final credo, but in the present volume readers will assuredly find the quest carried closer to its final terminus. Let them not think that the former volumes can now be ignored. Such a mistake would be fatal to their growth. The earlier teachings remain, but they are supply merited. Those writings will live and be needed so long as men have to struggle upward from stage to stage for truth, so long as human minds must ripen like the fruit on a tree, that is to say, they picture gates which cannot be avoided and must be entered and passed. There is no sudden miraculous transition into ultimate truth overnight for those who are in a breathless hurry. Therefore those earlier books, in representing as faithfully and as lucidly as my pen could do so what I indubitably thought, felt and experienced at the time they were written, are factual records which represent also what many others will perforce think and experience as they follow and progress along the same path. Einstein found that a ray of light curved its way through space. All earlier scientists took it for granted that it proceeded in a straight direction. Were they mistaken or were they liars? The theory of V relativity dispels both criticisms. It demonstrates that the earlier explanations were quite accurate when regarded from the standpoint where the observer had established himself. I was like a restless scientist working his way through one experiment after another in the laboratory towards a fuller understanding of them all. Even the accepted principles of mathematics have to be taken as possessing a relative character only. The thirst for absolute knowledge kept me from the lethargy of satisfaction with existing discoveries. It is true that I have written with strong conviction and with apparent dogmatism. The justification is that I have been practicing meditation for a quarter of a century and having found its benefits naturally sought to pass them on to others. I felt it necessary to play an advocate's part and forcefully to draw the attention of my fellow human beings in the West to the fact that such a line of experience was also open to them if they would but interest themselves in it. The present effort is more than a mere excursion into bookmaking. It is a structure of welded East-West thought built for our own age. It is a 20th century interpretation of a mellow old wisdom that captured the loyalty of grave-aged sages who lived long before Christ. It is a contribution towards the understanding of life's most obscure and paradoxically most important theme, written in response to the further pressure of fate and inclination. I shall frankly regard its present achievement and future completion as the highest and holiest task of my career so far.